Leadership Show with Andy Peck.
It's my joy once again to welcome you to the Leadership Show. I'm Andy Peck, your host, bringing you conversations I trust help you to be influential in God's purposes wherever you are and whatever your role. On this show, we like to emphasize that leading is something we all do one way or another as we use the influence we have. But that doesn't mean, of course, that we don't also celebrate those who have leadership roles of big organizations. And my guest today is Rich Stearns, who has served as a CEO in businesses selling games and China, including a business with 4,000 employees. He left business to accept a role as president of World Vision US, where he became the longest serving president in their 70-year history. His leadership career hasn't always been plain sailing. He was fired from two roles, including a time when he had moved his whole family to a new area to take up a CEO position. He's the author of a new book, Lead Like It Matters: Values-Driven Leadership in a Success-Driven World. And I'm really looking forward to chatting about his book and his career. He joins me today from his home in Seattle, Washington. So welcome, Rich, to the Leadership Show.
Well, thanks, Andy. It's great to be in the UK today.
So on this show, we speak of leading to further the purposes of God. So your book, Lead Like It Matters to God, fits right in. But you confess that you're not especially a fan of leadership books. So what made you write this one?
You know, over the course of my career, I never read a lot of leadership books. And I think it was because they always made me feel a little bit insecure and unworthy, you know, and you'd read some book by this glorious leader, and they would have all kinds of paradigms and new skill sets to master. And I always found them a little bit overwhelming. And so I never read many of them, but I wrote this book because I thought there was a void in that market of leadership books. I wanted to write a book from a Christian perspective that really talked about the character of the leader, you know, that my belief that God is much more concerned about a leader's character than how effective that leader might be even in their role. That at the end of the day, you know, it's about how we treat others and how we represent God in our workplaces that I think is more important ultimately.
The book is a lovely mix of your own principles and exploring the values that you believe are key to leadership. You say that God is not primarily interested in what many leaders assume he is interested in, namely success. How come?
Yeah, this may be the only leadership book you read that makes the statement that success is overrated. And, you know, in the U.S. and I think in Europe, there's a success-oriented culture that we are all living in. And I say, you know, success is everywhere around us. We celebrate the wealthiest people, the fastest-growing companies, the biggest churches, the most famous celebrities, the teams with the best winning records. You know, everywhere you look, we're celebrating success. And so, you know, I like to say we're kind of marinating in this success culture. And as Christians, we start to absorb this drive for success. And there's nothing wrong with being successful in the traditional sense of the word. But the point I wanted to make in the book is that, you know, success should not be our goal. The thrust of my book is to say, don't make success an idol in your life. You may be successful as a byproduct of being a person of character and a person who cares about others in the workplace, but don't make success your goal.
I'd like to chat about the values and your story. Which values would you say are bedrock ones without which you wouldn't appoint someone to a team that you were leading?
Yeah, well, that's right, Andy. You know, the book is about values-driven leadership, and I have one chapter on each of 17 different key leadership values that I believe the best leaders exhibit. And I think if I were to as I would look at hiring people, there's two or three of these values that I think are non-negotiable. And the first would be integrity. I mean, a person who does not have integrity, you know, has no business leading to begin with. And sadly, we've seen people in our politics and in our corporate world, we've seen people without integrity. We've seen people that put profit or success ahead of people with a horrible outcome. I think of the opioid pandemic in the United States, where pharmaceutical executives put profit ahead of their own customers. In fact, the programs, their marketing programs, were literally pushing more and more sales of opioid drugs, even though it was killing their customers. I mean, it was literally killing their customers. So a total lack of integrity. So integrity is very important. If you don't have integrity, you just can't be trusted to be a leader. I think humility is another characteristic in leaders that is important. And we don't think of leaders being humble. We think of them being bold and aggressive and take no prisoners. And, those are kind of the leaders that we celebrate often in the media. But humility means, I love the definition Rick Warren gave of humility. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. And so a humble leader looks at their role as, it's not about me being successful, it's about how can I help the people on my team to be successful, to realize their God-given talents and to achieve their goals. In other words, you're more like a coach or an orchestra conductor. You're trying to bring the best out of the players or musicians that are under your leadership. So, and then humility also says that as a leader, you realize you don't have all the answers. And so you surround yourself with good and smart people and you listen to them. You listen to their advice. You are a person who's willing to change their opinion based on what other people contribute to the conversation. And so I think integrity and humility would be probably two at the top of my list.
Your work as a CEO of World Vision USA is, of course, particularly interesting to us. Many in the UK are so grateful for charities like World Vision that address poverty issues. But you weren't initially keen to join. Perhaps you could tell us that story.
Yeah, I was a very reluctant recruit. So at the time, I was the CEO of Lennox Fine China. Now, for folks in the UK, Lennox is kind of the Wedgwood of the United States. It's the number one fine china brand here, and it's an old and storied company. I was at the height of my career, and the phone rang, and it was a recruiter who was representing World Vision US and looking for the new president. And so at first I thought, well, he's not calling to see if I'm interested because I have no qualifications for this job. I'm running a luxury goods company. I've never been to the developing world, never been to Africa. I have no theological degree, and World Vision is a Christian organization. So I didn't think I had any of the qualifications. So I was quite surprised when he said, well, I'm quite interested in you being a candidate for this job. And I kind of laughed at the moment, and I remember saying to him, I said, in this job, you're looking for someone that's part CEO, part Mother Teresa, and part Indiana Jones. And I said, I don't think you're going to find somebody that meets that criteria, but I will pick my brain. And if I can think of anyone, I'll let you know. Well, then he really kept persisting. And he said, I really think you would be an excellent candidate for this job. And I just kept trying to say no. And then he asked me the question, Rich, are you willing to be open to God's will for your life? And, and I thought, well, on the surface, you would answer that question. Well, sure, I'm a Christian. I want to be open to God's will for my life. But behind that question, Andy, were questions like, are you willing to leave your career, quit your job, take a huge salary reduction, move your family 3,000 miles across the country? And then deeper questions, are you willing to go into refugee camps and famine zones and hold dying children in your arms and be exposed to human suffering, on these trips? And I just felt it was kind of a God moment that I just felt like, is it possible that God is calling me into this new role? And so I reluctantly threw my hat into the ring, thinking that the board of directors would never in their right mind select me. So it seemed like I could be brave enough to throw my resume in, knowing that I'd never be picked. And then to my surprise, as the process went on, they chose me for the job. And so I very reluctantly said yes. I did it with a heavy heart. I was not, a Christian superhero that said, "Here I am, Lord, send me." It was like, "Oh no, Lord, do I really have to?" A lot like Moses, you'll remember how reluctant Moses was to go and confront the Pharaoh. But I did do it, and it led to the most rewarding 20 years of my life.
But you lasted a long time. So I'm wondering how your role changed through your 20 years with them.
Yeah, and it did evolve. That's a good question because, I think leaders have to find ways to reinvent themselves periodically because, you're leading for a few years and then the organization has different needs and requirements and you have to kind of reinvent the way you're leading. But in my case, I think my first few years, I was more of a chief operating officer. I was really, as a business person, I was digging into the financial dynamics and the marketing programs and all of those kinds of issues to, raise money and lower our overheads and do those kinds of things. But then as time went on, I realized, I've got to be more of a spokesperson to the public and to the various constituencies. In 2009, I wrote the book, The Hole in Our Gospel. It was really a book about poverty and justice. And in the U.S., it actually became a bestseller. And that kind of catapulted me more into a spotlight because I was now no longer anonymous. Often the leaders of World Vision are relatively anonymous, which I think is a good thing because they're not dominated by some big personality that or a founder who casts a big shadow. But after that book was written, I became much more of an external leader, speaking at churches, speaking at Christian conferences, speaking to officials in the U.S. government, advocating for justice for refugees and HIV and AIDS interventions. And so really becoming more of a spokesperson for the causes underlying World Vision's work around the world. And so at that point, I brought in a chief operating officer to work underneath me so that he could take over many of the day-to-day duties of running the organization, and I became more externally focused.
Now, World Vision is one of the many charities that provides assistance at a time of emergency. But I've read that in your view, too often aid assistance lacks insight. It's almost as if every problem is treated like an emergency, when things are more complicated than that. So can you say something perhaps about how we need experts in poverty alleviation to lead the way?
Yes, Andy. I think there's a real tendency, not just by churches or more amateur organizations, but even some of the big NGOs tend to put a Band-Aid on a very serious problem. If you put a Band-Aid on something, but you don't deal with the underlying causes, you're really not going to be very helpful in the long run. And so, one of the metaphors I use for poverty is it's people that are living in poverty in the developing world. It's almost like they're trapped in a spider web of underlying causes. So there's a strand of that spider web called education. There's a strand called economic opportunity or lack thereof. There's a strand called hunger and nutrition. There's a strand called clean water and sanitation. And, so there's multiple causes of poverty that are all interconnected. And so most charitable organizations actually just deal with one of those issues. They might deal with housing, or they might deal with clean water, or they might deal with food and hunger. And that's good. That's a good thing. But a family that's living in a village that is suffering from all of these underlying causes, it doesn't help them to have a new house. It doesn't help them just to deal with the education issue. You really have to treat all of these things simultaneously in a community. You've got to cut all the strands of the spider web to release the people that are trapped there. And so I wrote an article once for Christianity Today entitled "Solving Poverty is Rocket Science." And, I think amateurs think, well, we can help. People are hungry. Let's send food. Well, when you send food, you just create a dependency. Those people now depend on you to send them food. And then the farmers in the area can no longer sell their grain and their crops because some well-meaning church in Texas is sending them food every month, and so they don't buy the local crops and the farmers go out of business. And so there's a lot of unintended consequences if you approach poverty with an amateur's eye. You really need to know what you're doing, or you can actually do more harm than good.
So I guess what you would say to church leaders is to be careful what you sign up for, to be aware of the potential consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I think I applaud churches who want to be involved and want to help and want to do something. That's a great sentiment and a great enthusiasm. But what I would say is you really need to go to school on the underlying causes of poverty and what really is required to make a difference. And one of the best ways to do that is to partner with organizations that have been doing this for years and doing it successfully and go into partnership. You know, I often say to pastors in the United States, if you were going to build a new building for your church, you wouldn't just ask everybody to show up on Saturday with scrap lumber and tools. You'd hire an architect and a contractor and acoustics experts, and you'd order pews from the people that, you know, have built pews for 100 years, and you'd assemble a team of experts. So if you were going to do that to build a new church building, why would you think you could go into the middle of Africa and solve poverty that's been there for generations with a bunch of volunteers who really don't understand the underlying technical issues?
Rich, you visited the largest refugee camp in the world in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, one of a number worldwide. These are like small towns or cities. Is there any hope for people here? And what did you see of the church there?
There were, you know, something like 5,000 to 10,000 people just living in tents in this big field. They'd lost everything. They'd lost their homes. They'd lost loved ones. And you would think that there would be a sense of hopelessness in a place like that. And yet we visited on a Sunday morning, and that community of tent refugees had built a crude church using lumber and scrap metal, and there was a crude cross on top of the church, and it was kind of banded together with tarpaulins from the United Nations with UN logos on them, and hundreds of people were walking through the tents on their way to worship God in the middle of their trauma. And this is something I saw over and over again as I visited refugee camps. I call it the triumph of the human spirit, right? The will of human beings to persist and to have a better life and to overcome their problems. And so I think one of the roles that we can play, I mean, the refugee crisis in the world is at an all-time high. I think there's something like 80 million refugees and displaced people. It's the cause of massive human migration, as we all know, in the developed world, massive numbers of people trying to come to Europe, to the United States, to Canada, to Australia. And they're not coming because they want to leave their home country. They're coming because they're being forced out by violence and war and despotic rulers. So these people deserve our compassion and our help. I just think this is a moment where we can encourage people. Sometimes when you're in the middle of a trauma, you just need a friend to come alongside and say, you know what, I'm going to walk through this with you. I'm going to stand with you during this time of dislocation, and I'm going to help you with some of the things that you can't provide for yourself. And there's going to be a better day. There's going to be a day when you can maybe return to your country and be resettled. But in the meantime, we're going to walk with you, and we're going to embrace you. One of the most touching moments I saw was the Syrian refugees fleeing into Lebanon. And of course, the Syrians had been the oppressors of Lebanon. They occupied the country for something like 30 years during a long war. And just a few years later, the Syrian war broke out, and these refugees started to flee into Lebanon asking for help. And most people would say, you want us to help you after what you did to us? No way. But I found these Lebanese churches literally embracing these Muslim refugees coming from Syria, helping them find a place to live, helping them with food and clothing and shelter and clean water. And just that spirit of encouragement. And it was just amazing to see these Christians helping these Muslims and treating them with humanity.
The book focuses on the importance of values. I guess the key for many leaders listening is, how do I instill those values in others? Perhaps you have some tips.
I think the number one tip is that you have to model the values that you want others to embrace. And we do this naturally with our own children, right? When if you want your children to be honest and hardworking and, you know, all the things that you hope for your children, you show them by your example what it means to be honest and hardworking and concerned about your fellow man and those kinds of things. And so leaders, one of the most powerful things that leaders do, and sometimes they do it unwittingly, is they create the culture of the workplace in which they serve. So leaders are makers of culture, and you can create a very negative, toxic culture that is rife with workplace politics, or you can create a very redemptive culture that values people and values honesty, truth, hard work, excellence, humility. And so people take their cues from leaders. And at World Vision in the US, we used to talk about the tone at the top, and maybe the senior 12 or 15 leaders in our organization, we used to ask the question, what example are we setting? Are we quarreling with one another all the time and playing politics with each other? Or are we supporting one another and working together as a team? And because what we model to the organization, that's the cue that everyone else is going to take in terms of how they behave in the organization. And so I think just leaders have this powerful role. They can create a culture in which people can flourish if they lead with these kinds of values, integrity, humility, excellence, et cetera.
So Rich, how have you found the transition away from leading World Vision? You left, of course, in 2018.
Well, first of all, transition is a very important leadership moment as well. And, you know, a good leader tries to make for a smooth transition. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that I'd hired a chief operating officer a few years before I retired. And so I worked with the board of directors. I let them know well in advance when my retirement date was going to be and what day I'd selected. And I gave them, you know, a couple of years to think about how they were going to replace me and fill the job. And anyways, to make a long story short, we had a very orderly transition. Sometimes leaders are unwilling to let go of power, you know, and that creates dysfunction in an organization. And I just felt like, look, it's my time is done and it's time for a new leader. And I don't want to be the guy that people are whispering behind his back. When's the old boy going to leave, you know? And so I gave that kind of gift to the board. At the end of the day, they did a nationwide search and they selected my chief operating officer to replace me after doing a search. And it was a very smooth transition. And his name is Edgar Sandoval. He's leading the organization today. I'm loving retirement. I rarely set an alarm clock these days, although my body clock wakes me up by 7 every morning. And as you know, I wrote this book in my first year of retirement and brought it through the publishing process. I'm trying to, you know, someone once told me that you have three stages in your career as a leader. You know, you're a warrior, you're fighting your way through an organization or in your career. And then you become a king where you're a leader of people. And, you know, and finally you become a sage, you become a person that has some wisdom. And so I'm doing some coaching of younger leaders and some advising. But, you know, I'm not working full time. I'm really just trying to help other leaders be successful.
Well, thank you, Rich. You've certainly shared your sage advice with us today. So the book again is Lead Like It Matters to God, Values-Driven Leadership in a Success-Driven World. And you can get a copy by going online. Eden Books apparently sell one in the UK. So you could get one from there or your local Christian bookshop if you are close to one. So my great joy to have you with us this week, Rich. Thank you so much for all that you've shared.
Thanks, Andy. It's great to be with you.
It was great to chat with Rich Stearns. So maybe this week will be one where you don't think of less of yourself, but think of yourself less as you focus on others. Surrounding yourself with good people, as Rich has suggested, and caring for those that God brings across your path. I was also impressed by the unexpectedness of where Rich ended up as president of World Vision US. And you never know, maybe God has an unexpected future for you too. This is Andy Peck, praying that you have a good week and are able to lead like it matters to God. because it really does.
The Leadership Show. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.